Hey, this is John St. Augustine. Welcome to Throwback Thursday. It's actually Halloween, which was the biggest holiday at around my house growing up as a kid. Just a couple days ago, I went back to the old neighborhood to get a haircut. Now, let me just give you a full disclosure here. I really don't have hair anymore. I basically have quills of some sort sticking out of my head, but there's enough to cut. So, you know, I still got that going for me, and it's only like $12 and $15 with a tip. Are you kidding me? All cash on the barrel head. Ray does a fantastic job. Usually got to wait like 3 hours to get in line and sift through six-year-old People magazine and whatever's on the tube. Luckily, he has the sound off, so we're not assaulted too much while we wait to get our hair cut. But every time I go back there, something happens to me. It's kind of like being dipped in magic waters. I go swimming through waves of emotion and waves of memories, and so much of that happens around this time of year. So let's go back to Halloween at our house. Those sound effects you heard coming in are from the, I think it was a Grammy-winning, a million-selling album by the Disney Studios called The Chilling, Thrilling Sounds of the Haunted House. And it was on a, you know, regular 33 and a third album. And it was the background of my life from probably the first part of October till just right after Halloween, whatever day that would fall on, because that's what my dad would use to create the soundtrack that would play through the air vents in the basement of our house that he transformed with a bunch of my cousins and friends and other people in the family into this haunted castle every year. My dad was quite a guy. He was a banker by day, but he was enamored since he was a kid, really, with science fiction and horror movies and all those kind of things when you can go to the theater back in the day for like a dime or a quarter, whatever it was. And he loved that stuff. And so as he got older, he found himself with a family and career, and the way he enjoyed himself was scaring the absolute shit out of people. So this was something that he looked forward to. You know, Christmas was a big deal, but nothing compared to Halloween. So I'm not sure when exactly it started, except I do know I was about 8-9 years old, somewhere there, so the late 60s, and he and his friends got together and decided that they were going to do this haunted house in our basement. Now, at the time, he was in his 30s, banker by day and ghoul by night. And it was just the biggest kick I ever got was watching him transform. He would sit in his bedroom in front of this huge mirror on a stool, and my mom would transform him basically into a kind of a composite of Bela Lugosi and Christopher Lee. It was fantastic. He had a friend of his who was a dentist, and he had fangs made. I'm not kidding. At some point, for some odd reason, I had black curtains in my bedroom, which faced the highway. And I think part of it was to keep my mom said to knock the sound down and keep the light out. I think it's just because later on she took the curtains down and she used them to make my dad's Dracula cape out of him. Big frock neck and the whole drill. It was quite a thing. So they spared no expense and they really went all out. And this was a time long before all these, you know, haunted houses now that you got to sign, you know, disclosure and disclaimers for to get in. They're not going to assume because it scares you too much and pay $40 a head. My dad charged a quarter to walk through our basement and have the absolute bejesus scared out of you. And it went from probably, like I said, 65, 6, 7, somewhere in there, well into the 1980s. And then finally, that was really the end. It was about a 20-year run. And during that time, it was legendary. It had gotten written up a couple times in Chicago newspapers. Kids and adults alike would line up outside of our house, which was right on a corner next to an alley, all the way down the alley, 5, 6, 7 days in a row to do this haunted house. It was like this, it was really, truly a big deal. I wish there were more pictures from that time. My dad just lived for it. And he had this whole cadre of people that helped him. And one of my most fondest memories of those years was coming home from grammar and high school later and seeing all my cousins' cars parked out in front, because I knew that meant they were in the basement cleaning things and getting it ready. And the way they set this up was very interesting. So every year my dad would kind of alter the maze of horror, as it were. The main thing that never changed was Dr. Frankenstein's laboratory. It was the first thing that you saw when you walked in the basement. First, of course, you had to sign in blood on this really cool stand that he built. It was all black, and he had a skull on the back with a light on it and all this stuff. It was great. And a red pen. And somewhere, my sister probably has it, is that ghoul guest book. You had to sign in who you were, what your name was, and leafing through that stuff after my dad passed was really incredible. But you'd walk in, and he actually had found an old washing machine door somewhere. It was a front loader, so it had glass in it, kind of curved glass. So he actually cut a hole in the door, the entrance to the basement, no less. He switched it out when it wasn't Halloween, but he cut a hole in the door, and then he bolted this window in there, and then he smeared it with Vaseline, so it was all foggy and weird looking. And so when people walked in, the first thing they saw through that window, that glass, was Frankenstein's laboratory, man. And in the early days, it was a friend of mine, dad, who he knew from school, named Tom. And Tom was the original Dr. Frankenstein in the basement. He had a smock on, and he had this weird hair thing on, and it was quite a drill. And Mr. Stitch from across the street volunteered to be Frankenstein. He was a bigger guy, and he'd come over and, you know, get in there. And they had this lab set up that was really done well. It had switches and lights. It was way ahead of its time. And my Uncle Hal, who really wasn't my uncle, but he earned the nickname and the title, he was a fantastic artist. He was a commercial artist for a time. So he drew all the books and the stuff on the shelves. And somewhere, we still have his artwork tucked away. And so that's the first thing you saw. So you'd walk in there. My dad would greet you. You know, he's Dracula, the good evening and all that stuff. And then he'd walk into the lab and he'd show you the lab. And there was, of course, Tom, a.k.a. Dr. Frankenstein, and the Frankenstein's monster, a.k.a. Mr. Stitch, going at it, doing their thing. And they'd get scared out of that. And then they'd go through this maze and meet all kind of ghouls and monsters and all kind of stuff. And it was just a thrill of a lifetime. So when they built this, they always put the bottom part of the maze in first so they could obviously see which way where people were going. And my dad, I have it posted on my Facebook page. My dad would sit there, you know, for like 6 months out of the year designing the maze and the whole thing. And he'd write it out in longhand. And I still have one of those pieces of paper in a file that it was his handwriting. It was very cool. And they'd build this thing. And like I said, for 5, 6, 7 nights a year, people would line up and walk through once, twice, three times. And people were carried out. They couldn't go any further. My dad's like, all right, that's it. Out you go. So it was fantastic. And really one of the mainstays of the cast of characters there was my cousin Rich, the Sarge, who had just come back from Vietnam. And he gained duty as the werewolf. And he was chained at the bottom of the stairs, man. He would put the spirit gum on his face and he built the whole jaw thing. And his wife Marie was like the gypsy woman, like in the movie, and she'd hold them back. And the cool part was, and this was so great, they tested it on me first, and I even know the guy, and it scared the shit out of me. What they did is they had these plastic chains, see? And they had the chains attached to the wall at the bottom of the stairs, and there was a light there. And so when people would walk up to him, you couldn't see him. And my dad would step on this light switch, and the light would go on red over him, and there would be... And he would be chained up, and he'd be like, don't worry, he's chained to the wall, he can't harm you. Well, what they had done, brilliant, 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 brilliant. They had these plastic chains, but on the end, they took coat hangers, and they bent them to look like the chain links, and they wrapped them in black tape, and they clamped them around his wrist, but he'd break free, and he'd come after you. I saw people about faint right on the spot. It was so great. And when I was younger, I was the last monster in the whole thing. We had a caveman in there. Rich's brother Bob was dressed like a caveman, and he turned a light on, and he'd scream at you, and he had a rubber spider fly out of his mouth. It was just great. And the memories were just fantastic. But when I was a little kid, I was the last monster at the top of the steps. I was in an oilcloth with a really bad, horrible face on, just sitting there, and people didn't know if I was real or not. They'd walk by and... It was so cool. And later on in life, when I was in high school, some of my friends got involved when the slasher movie started becoming into vogue. We had this guy, Mike, who was a goalie on our hockey team at Schur's. And he was able to sit for long periods of time, because he's a goalie and they know how to do this, with his leg really, one of his legs behind his back. And he put a fake leg in front of that in the same pants, like, you know, jeans or something. And my dad would walk people up and the light would go on and he'd be sitting there and he'd look up. And he had like a hockey mask on. It was blood all over it. And he had a circular saw in his hands. And the saw was, it didn't have a blade in it, but he had it plugged in and it, that sound, you know, and he'd start cutting his leg off. And I got to tell you, it was and the things he'd say to these people, I mean, unbelievable stuff. So all in all, it was fantastic. So Halloween at our house was a big friggin' deal. I mean, a big deal. So I wanted to kind of do something on Throwback Thursday and talk about that a little bit. And tied to all that, such great memories for me. Matter of fact, when my dad passed away, my sister and I decided to put his Dracula cape in for the cremation. It was that important to him. So the transition from banker guy who worked at Six Corners sitting behind a desk with his hair slicked back to this, you know, the undead, the Nosferatu, was so stunning. People literally who knew him didn't believe he was the same guy. That's how good it was. When I first started in radio, I wanted to include Halloween-type programs every year, of course, and there was no one else better to talk to than the late, great Richard Crowe, my good friend and one of the original ghost hunters. Before all this stuff's on now, Richard was doing it then, but more importantly, he was an historian as well. He wasn't just a guy running around looking for creepy stuff. He had a historical bend to all these stories. He was a fascinating human being. I actually dedicate the book that I have coming out now called Phenomena, Sacred Moments, Messages, and Memories, and Other Shit I Can't Explain, to Richard, because he really is the guy that put the normal in paranormal, and that's hard to do. So this is a clip from 20 years ago. 1999 was my second year on the air. I was in Michigan doing the show, and Richard was my guest. And the first thing I thought of when I heard this was I 12? My voice sounds just a little bit different. So happy Halloween, safe travels, and enjoy this clip.
He is world-renowned as, I guess you could say, as the ghost hunter and all that goes with that. Richard, good morning.
Good morning, John.
How are you doing down there in Chicago?
Oh, fine.
One of the most haunted places in the planet, isn't it?
Yes, as we are getting into the most haunted season of the year, too. So it's a very great place to be at.
Do you think that is there always more paranormal activity, as it were, during this time of year? Or is it just that we're more focused on it?
Well, John, as I'm sure you well know, is that the ancient Celts thought that the fall time was a time when the veil between the living and the dead was thinner, that contact could be made. That's why we have Halloween, based on the Druids' belief. That's why the Christian Church adopted All Saints Day, All Souls Day for this time of the year. So it's the right time of year, I think.
It's the right time. You know what? There's so many shows on TV now. You have sightings, and you have weird and strange, and you have all this stuff out there, and it seems to be on the increase. I don't know if the activity's on the increase, but there are more and more people, it seems, beginning into this area that you've spent so much time in. Tell me, why did you get into all this?
Well, first of all, I got into it back in the 70s, and I'm sure you remember the days of Carillion photography and psychic fairs and pyramid power and things of that sort. Well, I grew up in that era. I mean, that was in my younger days, and that's when, I guess because of my background, which is interest in travel, and my dad was in trucking for many years, I put together a tour in 1973 for my geography professor at DePaul University here in Chicago. Mm-hmm. No one had ever done supernatural travel before, and that first tour took everybody by surprise when it turned away 200 people.
Wow.
And that was the basis for my my entire career, doing a class project for a geography professor. And any students out there listening, never turn down a project, kids. You never know where it might lead. Lead to job security and career security for the rest of your life.
I bet you could never have predicted, what, 20-some-odd, 25 years later that you'd
25 see? Years, exactly. One quarter of a century this Halloween.
Is it really?
I started to feel old.
So you've been doing this for 25 years.
Been doing the tours and related activities for 25 years, John. And, well, that's 25 years since my first trip. I went full-time in 1979, so I'm 19 years doing this exclusively for my living. I can actually put Ghost Hunter on my 1040. Not that I would, because it's a red flag for IRS.
I was going to say, what could you possibly write off besides everything, you know?
Right. No, I put tour guide and lecturer there just to hedge my bets.
But besides just the touring, which is taking the people on the buses and doing things, you've done a lot of research. You spent a lot of time researching this activity and the many angles of it, don't you?
Right. The way to get the material for the tours is to go out there and do the legwork and find these locations. But then once you get some momentum going, of course, I meet people constantly who are giving me new leads and new information. So by telling the stories to people, and it's usually a very receptive crowd, then people open up and they share their experiences. And that's the fun of it. I get to meet different people with experiences that might dovetail with what I've already picked up or maybe make some brand new discovery. You never know when you're going to make a new discovery. I got a quick story on that for you, too.
Sure.
Last year, I went to Hong Kong, China, and Macau on vacation. And, of course, whenever I go anywhere on vacation, I'm looking for the supernatural side of things.
Mm-hmm.
So I come back, and I'm all hot and bothered about Chinese supernatural beliefs. And, boy, they are quite superstitious.
Mm-hmm.
Well, everybody's superstitious. It's just they express it in a different way. And so I began to do some work in Chinatown here in the south side of Chicago. And I actually found a block with four ghost stories. One block, John. It's a short one.
Wow.
That's my personal best. There's a haunted restaurant where a suicide had taken place years ago, a second suicide location, a basement apartment. There's an apartment building across the street where a lot of elderly Chinese men, and of course, first immigration from China was strictly limited to men 99% of the time, so a lot of yang, not enough yin, people dying lonely after lonely separations from their families and loved ones. That place is haunted, and then a community center at the end of the block with a little old lady ghost. And that's now become the basis of a new package, which is called Supernatural Chinatown. But I had never even known that, and that's last year.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say, 23 and a half years into the business,
yeah.
And I didn't know that I was already missing, I had been missing the most haunted block around Chicago, at least so far. I may find another one more haunted, but I doubt it. Four in one block is pretty good.
That's amazing. You talk about in the business. Are there other people that do what you do in the way that you do it?
Well, I'm the only person doing this full-time in the metro Chicagoland area. There are a few people now who are trying to do it around Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
However, I'm very proud to say I'm the first one to do a supernatural tour bus on a regular basis anywhere in the world.
Right.
And every larger metropolitan area, and even some smaller communities now, either have walking tours or bus tours or something. They seem to be springing up all over the place. Interesting, in London, where you'd think there'd be a lot of this activity, the guy that runs the local bus tour there actually gets up at the beginning of the show and says that he got the idea by watching an Arthur C. Clarke program,
yeah.
Strange Powers of the Mind, and seeing this guy in Chicago doing a tour.
Yeah.
So he actually got the whole idea from watching me on TV.
Too bad you couldn't have found out a way to franchise this thing.
I don't know. It's sort of like out of control already, Chad. It's
exactly.
Like, how would you ever collect the royalties? It's like trying to collect royalties on bootleg CDs from China or something.
Yeah.
It's impossible.
So you've been doing this all this time, and I'm always wondering, you talk about people being superstitious, and maybe they're a little bit more superstitious in China than they are here. But it seems that a lot of things will happen in our lives either we can't explain or would rather not explain. And I don't think I've ever met anybody, and you could probably, corroborate on this or not, that hasn't had something at some point stop them and say, what's going on here? Or is there something bigger than me or outside of me or something I can't see? And most of the time, that scares us, doesn't it?
Yes. People always have a ritual. They have some kind of a personal quirk in how they do things, which somebody else who's not familiar with it would call superstition. It just, as you say, it just goes to show that we know that we're not alone here, that mankind is just lower on the totem pole, so to speak, and there's mm-hmm. other entities, there's other intelligences higher than ours, and so we want to make sure that we placate them.
I bet you make the rounds. You know, we haven't talked, it's been a year since we spoke, but I bet you just, as things go, as the books that are out on the market, the not so much the self-help, but the self-empowerment where people are looking for higher parts of themselves and all that, do you get more and more people coming to you with this stuff now?
Not only do I get that, John, but I'm invited to speak in churches now a lot, too.
Really?
And I personally take that as sad commentary that people aren't able to get what they need in the church as it is.
Yeah.
So the church is reaching out for me, and I'm certainly trying to share my information and help people.
Who contacts you at a church to have you come in and speak at a church?
Recently, just to drop a few names, I did a local Catholic church here on the south side of Chicago. I spoke, this is not from the pulpit, I mean, we're talking about
right.
for their auxiliary activities here.
Sure.
This was for a senior group, more recently at a Catholic church on the 55th Street here on the south side. Mm-hmm. And just a couple of weeks before that, I did the 4th Presbyterian Church on Michigan Avenue, which is really interesting when you consider the fact the 4th Presbyterian Church, if you ever see it, it's that beautiful place of cloisters. It's got real Gothic architecture. It's right at Michigan Avenue, directly across from the John Hancock Building.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking about how the John Hancock across the street is built on cursed land because that land was placed under a curse by Cap Streeter, the guy that actually created everything from Michigan Avenue east to Navy Pier, from Oak Street Beach to Navy Pier east of Michigan Avenue, which is the landfill because it used to be just a swamp flat,
right.
Sand flats, and so forth. And I'm talking about the place being cursed. I didn't realize it at the time. That's where they draw the revenue from. They own the land the Hancock is on,
yeah.
and they're the beneficiaries of all the profits from the cursed land across the street.
I bet that went over real big, huh?
So I was, see, but it's always, we're always learning. I mean, you might be out of school for a few years, but you're always learning.
Absolutely. We're speaking with Richard Crowe. He is the world-renowned ghost hunter and the guy that's seeking out all the creepy crawlies and things that we're looking to avoid a lot of times. We're going to take a quick 90-second break, and we'll be right back. We're back here with Richard Crowe. He is known worldwide as the ghost hunter. How did that name come about? I mean, you don't actually hunt them, do you?
Well, yes, that's a very bad term as far as I'm concerned from a personal level, because whenever people start saying ghost hunter, well, the perception is, for the most part, that I like try to do them in or
right,
get
right.
rid of them or something. Or actually, I suppose a more correct term in this politically correct age would be ghost conservationist.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really trying to observe them, study them, and make sense out of them.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I mean, ghost hunter, it goes back to literature, goes back to earlier tellers of ghost stories, so I don't mind it. It's just right. I then correct people and let them know exactly how I approach ghost hunting.
What are some of the most eerie things that have ever occurred on some of your trips? I mean, you get, what, 100 people on a bus, I suppose, at some point you go out and visit?
Well, max is 70 people.
70 people?
On a articulated coach, right.
Uh-huh.
There's only 48 coaches like that in that were ever made. Prevost Company up in Canada, they've got these 78 passenger articulated coaches.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God for those that can haul some bigger numbers and work a little bit less. I mean, I'm out there as much as I can, but I mean, at least I don't have to hustle mm-hmm. extra buses to make the numbers up.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been a lifesaver. But actually, John, the most unique experiences that I've had in my career in supernatural travel were in not with the bus, but the most unusual experiences were at a haunted house down in Louisiana called the Myrtles. You may have heard about this. It's been on A&E. Many people have talked about the Myrtles being the most haunted house in America. It's been billed as that. And I think they might even be right.
Really?
I hesitate to use superlatives that I can't, you know, back up
sure.
totally.
Sure.
But certainly it's one of the most haunted. It's got to be one of the top haunted houses around.
What? Before we go into that story a little bit, what constitutes a haunted house? What deems that this is haunted?
Well, what I'm looking for when I want to designate a place as haunted, I want continuity. I want ongoing occurrences, or at least ongoing for a few decades. Maybe it's dormant now, but there had to be some kind of a background there where it was going on for some time. So it's not just a one-shot situation, but it's got to be recurring again and again with multiple witnesses and with people who don't know one another and mm-hmm. get some documentation that way.
Hmm. And is there a group or a task force or somebody that says, yes, this is a haunted house, or is it an individual thing with paranormal investigators?
Yeah, it's an individual thing, so just check the credibilities of the people who are making the claims and check them very closely. But to get back to the portals for a second, you got to get down there sometime yourself, John.
Oh, sure. I'll be on the next plane.
A lot of interesting elements. Well, I do it on a tour every spring.
Really?
I do a New Orleans package for 3 days, 2 nights.
Wow.
But then we go, that's the basic tour.
Uh-huh.
And those who are really hardcore want to continue, we take 2 extra days, we carpool it, and we go up north of Baton Rouge, up the river, up the Mississippi, and we go to a hamlet called St. Francisville. There's a 200-year-old mansion there, 200-year-old plantation house called the Myrtles. First of all, mistake number one, it was actually built on Native American burial grounds.
Mm-hmm.
The grounds are cleared, and the house is built there, right there on that spot.
Wow.
Now, you know, when you start dissing people's graves like that, you're going to have problems. The basis of the movie Poltergeist, I mean, just common sense is that you don't go around desecrating graveyards,
sure,
no matter what culture put them there. So this house is built. And the story is there's actually been 10 untimely deaths in 200 years that have taken place there at that house.
Hmm.
And the first series started this way. The master of the house, the plantation owner, who had been actually one of General Washington's right-hand men, his name was Bradshaw, he comes down to Louisiana to get a Spanish land grant because he broke with Washington over Washington's harsh treatment of the farmers during the Whiskey Rebellion, which is really a revolt against high taxes. Here, you know, all these poor slobs had gone out and fought against England because of high taxes, and what happens? The highfalutin new American government starts putting new taxes on people again. So,
does that sound familiar? Huh?
Yeah. So it's we won't make any political comments, but anyway, it was not a great way to treat the veterans of the American Revolution, and then they were brutally suppressed by George Washington at that time, and he just was a populist enough to be upset about that. He decided he had enough, he fought for freedom, and he wasn't getting it, so he's going to start all over again. He goes to Louisiana, he gets a Spanish land grant, and he sets up this this plantation. Well, he's master of the house, he's got a slave named Chloe. Chloe is eavesdropping one day, so to teach her a lesson, he cuts her ear off. Well, times are a bit harsh back then.
Yeah.
He cuts her ear off, and of course, from that time on, she's got to wear that her headpiece, her turban there, low over the side of her face to cover that disfigured ear. And she's vowing revenge. So she makes a poison cake for the master. Unfortunately, before he can eat it, his two daughters get into it.
Oh.
They die. She's, of course, her intended victim gets away. She now really has a problem. Comes out that she poisoned the two girls, and her own fellow slaves took her out and hung her from a live oak tree behind the house.
Jeez.
So that's deaths 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah.
And then it just goes on. But any room you stay in the big house, and you can, it's like a bed and breakfast. You can stay there. Any room you stay in, it's like almost a different story. We could do a movie here because each room would be like a different vignette from history.
Jeez.
And do we have a minute to tell the story?
Yeah, go ahead.
It's a little bit long. I'll try to encompass this here in a more timely version here. First time I stayed there, the place really does give off just vibes. When you approach it, you know there's something odd about this place. My room was at the top of the stairs, the second floor of the plantation house, first door to the right. I'm staying in that room with a Cook County police officer buddy of mine, who you would think would be very tough as nails, down to earth, and not afraid of anything. And he's the guy who's saying, "Don't turn the lights off. We're not going to sleep with the lights off in this room tonight," clutching a crucifix in bed.
Oh, jeez.
And so I'm going, "Chuck, I can't sleep with the lights on. Come on, we got to turn the lights off." He's on the four-poster bed. I'm in the day bed because I'm 6'3". I could not fit in that little guy bed over there. So I'm stretched out. In fact, I'm diagonal because it's very uncomfortable. I'm too tall for this bed. But I'm stretched out on my back, hands across my chest, lights in my eyes, and I knew that I was awake. The light was burning in my eyes.
Mm-hmm.
At least I could have sworn I was awake. When I feel something in the palm of my right hand, I look down, John, and there was a silver woman's ring with a purple stone on it.
In your hand?
In the palm of my hand. It just apported. It just materialized. I'm going, "Wow, that just showed up." And I, like a fool, I take the ring and I slip it on my little finger. It's so tiny. Only went up to the first knuckle of my little finger, my right hand. The minute I did that, I knew that I really had done something foolish. because I felt an electric shock go up my finger and my hand and my arm and my body, and I was just feeling, I was just fighting paralysis.
Wow.
There was a paralysis taking me over, and it took every ounce of strength I could summon up to yell to my cop friend,
yeah,
Chuck, help me. Chuck, help me.
Wow.
Chuck runs out of bed. Just by merely speaking, I regain control of my body, my situation. Uh-huh. I'm jumping out of bed, and Chuck and I run out of the room. Chuck's banging on the door across the hall for this other couple in our party,
uh-huh,
Bob and Alice. Bob's an attorney, mm-hmm, his wife Alice. Bob, Alice, wake up. Rich found his ghost, Chuck's screaming. So then they open the door and run in. Well, there was no ring at that point.
Yeah.
And I went, I wouldn't go back in the room later until the daybreak, but when,
yeah,
I went back that day, that next day, there was no ring. So Bob and Alice, Chuck and myself spent the night in Bob and Alice's room.
I would imagine.
Scared witless.
Yeah.
But what's curious, John, is that as we entered the room, Bob had been sleeping. Alice let us in. Bob was waking up just as I was, as Chuck was banging on the door and Chuck and I were running into the room. Bob was having a nightmare in which he walked down the stairs to the first floor of the house and he saw a veiled woman. And he reaches out to touch her from behind, and he feels a ring on her hand.
Oh, jeez.
At that point, he's yelling, who, in his sleep. And Alice could hear him yelling, who. And that's when the banging of the door woke him up. So I know, I'm very familiar with the psychological situation of a waking dream. And undoubtedly, what I had was a waking dream. But I do think there was some kind of a telepathic tie-in here, mm-hmm, with something else. I had a ring element in my situation. Bob had a ring element in his. We're simultaneously having some kind of experience here that has similar elements. So something was feeding that to us. And in fact, the room that I spent the night in, along with Chuck, we found out later, is where a Civil War soldier had died of fever and being tended by his fiance. So whether this was some kind of recreation, and the joke later was that I'm now engaged to a ghost who gave me a ring.
Yeah.
But all these elements are so very weird. This is the kind of very strange, going back into the past, intersecting with the past type scenarios, mm-hmm, that do take place at the Myrtles.
Mm.
And if any of your listeners ever want to go there,
yeah,
it certainly is worth a trip. And like I said, it's a bed and breakfast. I take a group of about 10 people. We actually take over every room.
Mm.
So we take like 10 to 12 people. That's all we can handle. We take over the entire house.
Where are some of the other places, Richard, that you go, even in the city of Chicago? There's a lot of... Do you do a thing with the St. Valentine's Day Massacre? Is that...
The St. Valentine's Day Massacre is quite a popular site.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one that's got a lot of backup as well, John. The St. Valentine's Day Massacre, of course, 1929, just very quickly to give your listeners the history. Henchmen of Al Capone, disguised as Chicago police in uniform, descend upon this garage, pretending to be real cops. The Moran gang thinks that they are real. They let them in. They follow orders. They line up against the back wall of the building to be frisked, or so they thought. When they turned their backs, they were shot down. Machine gun fire, spray left to right, and then shotgun blast to the head. Take out 7 men. 6 instantly, and the 7th man would die at a nearby hospital some hours later. So that's how it came down. And that location, of course, was big news, because 7 men dead at once in one incident like this just, mm-hmm, didn't happen. I mean, it wasn't like crime is today, where people spray crowds. I mean, in those days, you weren't a target unless you were a player.
Right.
And there was a code of honor here, believe it or not, among the bootleggers and such.
Mm-hmm.
But 7 men dead at once was outrageous, so it was national news, international news. People descended upon this garage seeking to go in. And eventually, of course, to change Chicago's image, our late mayor, Richard J. Daley, in 1967, decided to tear down this building. He did a number of other buildings, too, that had a gangster tie-in.
Mm-hmm.
The building went down. In its place, a retirement home was built, run by the CHA, the Chicago Housing Authority. The exact spot where the men died, south end of the property. We've got a yard with 5 trees, like the 5 spots on a playing card. Behind the center tree is precisely where the men died. And this is where, in the late 60s, after there was accessibility, and now you could stand and walk right over the spot, people began to claim they were having ghostly experiences.
Hmm.
They said that they could hear the sounds of sobbing and moaning at night. Well, skeptics said, come on, it's your imagination. But not only do people have experiences here, but animals react too.
Hmm.
And yuppies walking their dogs there, they see the dogs stare and growl, pull the leash, and so forth. So you've got the added testimony there, if you will, of animals. So it's animal,
right,
and human reports. There's something going on here at this site.
I can remember a cousin of mine. being down there probably in the mid-70s, 72, 73, somewhere in there. And I guess one part of the story, there was a dog that was killed or was there at
right.
the time. That
Highball was the German Shepherd that was in the garage that day. Stories vary as to what happened. Highball witnessed the massacre.
Right.
And the dog was just so crazed after that. One story is that the police just had to put him down in the alley right after that because the dog was just insane watching everybody get killed.
Yeah,
that was the one story. But certainly if the dog did not die on the premises, it's well known that there was a dog there at the St. Valentine's Day Massacre that day.
Yeah.
Perhaps, you're right, maybe what these animals are picking up on, maybe they're indifferent to the human suffering, or maybe the human suffering is only part of it, and maybe they're also picking up on the canine suffering of that day with Highball, the German Shepherd.
Interesting, huh?
So that gives it a different twist, too, because a lot of people don't realize that there are animal ghosts.
Oh, we're going to talk about that in a second here, because I know a lot of people that their cats show up after they've been put down.
Sure.
Very amazing, amazing stories. I'm going to share a personal one here. We're speaking with Richard Crowe. He's known far and wide as the ghost hunter, which I know is probably not the best word for you, but maybe the ghost negotiator. This is the guy that kind of brings the living, I guess, to those who have passed on, so we can maybe learn a little bit and maybe correct our history and get on with some things. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back. We're spending the morning with Richard Crowe. Richard, right before we took the break, you were talking about ghost animals, pets, things like that. Is that a common occurrence?
It's not real common. Well, actually, it's hard to say, John, because very often these are very personal situations, and people don't talk about this readily just because it's like a family situation. But I think it happens a lot more than people realize, and it could be dog ghosts, cat ghosts, horses. Interesting horse situation, not with family pets or anything like that, but on 95th Street in Keene, southwest out of Chicago, in fact, just a few minutes' drive from where I'm speaking right now, I live in Oak Lawn, not far from here, there is a long existing horse path that crosses 95th Street, which is a very busily traveled road. The horse path, unfortunately, is on high ground. So when you're crossing the road, if people are not paying attention or they're going faster than conditions, faster than they should be, they're approaching this high ground. Suddenly they're on top of this scenario of horse riders crossing the road, and there have been a number of accidents there, and there's been one fatality to a human, and a number of horses have been injured, and some had to be put down at the spot. Excuse me. Some years ago, I taught high school for 1 year, and one of my students who was very much into this sort of material, she stayed in touch with me, and she and her fiancé, soon-to-be husband, were driving back from a party along 95th Street one night, and as they're approaching this very site, they see on the high ground fog or mist. They're slowing down as they see this, and the headlights of their car catch silhouettes of a horse and rider crossing the road. Now, for one thing, think about this. Got high ground and you've got mist or fog, but you don't have mist or fog in the low ground.
Yeah, that's unusual.
None of this makes sense. Yeah. And it just was an otherworldly situation. And so that was their experience with this.
Well, you know, one of the things that happened to me that I will never forget, I had this dog for 13 years. He was a boxer. And it was one of those relationships I suppose a lot of people have with their pets where, you know, we went through so much together. We spent all this time together. And it was one of those real one-on-one relationships with a dog. And whether I traveled or whatever, there was a couple times that I couldn't physically have him where I was stationed in the service, and I had to give him away, and he came back like a boomerang, and there was another time I had moved back home, and it just wouldn't have worked out, and he was gone for 2 days. The people couldn't handle him, so we gave up and said, okay, you know, he's got to be here. When I had to put that dog to sleep, I put him down after a long, he was getting, you know, sicker and sicker and those kind of things. I didn't know exactly what to do with him, but I knew I was going to cremate him. So I had the dog cremated, and there's a place, a forest preserve out where you, near where you take the tour out by Alexander Robinson. Mm-hmm. And there's some trees out there, and there was this one pine tree in particular. And I thought, you know, we had spent a lot of time out here, and I don't know if it was against the law or not, but I'm going to put Jake's ashes or a good portion of them right by this tree because we spent so much time there. So this was right before Thanksgiving. I'd put him down, and I think it was Thanksgiving morning, you know, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, whatever it was. And I went in and dug a little hole behind that tree, and then I put the ashes in the ground, and I kind of sat there for a while, and it was a beautiful day, and I kind of left it at that. The next day, I came back to take a walk, and what was interesting to me, because by that time, the ground at this particular time of the year was pretty hard. It was already cold. We had a lot of freeze already, and so it took me a lot of effort to get that into the ground and then cover it up and stamp it down and all those kind of things, and there was really nothing there for an animal to dig for, because it was cremated. There was just, you know, ashes. The next day I came back, the day after Thanksgiving, and all the ashes were out in a pile, sitting on the ground next to the tree. And they weren't in a perfect little pyramid or anything, but they were had been taken out, or they were out. Of course, the ground was all, you know, burrowed out too. And I found it, I was just, it went through me. I thought, what the heck is this? What animal would do this? And there was, the ashes were literally, they were mixed in with the dirt, but most of them were separated. And I just found it amazing, because I put them in a big clump and I covered them up. And here they were sitting outside next to this tree. And I've never forgotten that. And there's been a couple times since then that I could have swore, you know, that I heard him barking at some point there. And, you know, it's like you said, the psychological part, how much do I want to hear it and those kind of things. But it's just one of the strangest things that's ever happened, because of that. The first thing I thought of was, well, I guess you're not ready to be in the ground, you know. And it's just amazing to me, those little nuances. But we all have those things, don't we?
Oh, yes.
And it's amazing, I guess, to me, how many people discount them.
And what's important in your story too, John, and for any listeners who are trying to decide whether or not they've had an experience, is that most of these experiences are incredibly subtle.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
It's just observing.
Yeah.
Constant observation. And I think one of the reasons why I'm good at what I do, I think I'm good at what I do, at finding these stories, is that I grew up as a stamp collector, coin collector, where you're looking at very minute,
right,
tiny little details, you know.
Right.
Is this mint mark double? Is this has this been re-engraved?
Mm-hmm.
There's some slight
mm-hmm.
difference about things, and then that's what tips you off. There's something unique about this situation, and I think it's that kind of training. Thank goodness I fell into that as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Being obsessed with small detail that allows me to figure out which places are, you know, quote haunted unquote,
right,
so to speak, and to figure these places out as being different.
Now, what about the entities themselves, or these experiences you talk about? The house down in Louisiana and the horse and all that. Is there something in your experience or your observation of these happenings? Are we supposed to be learning something? Is it they talk about the afterlife, and we talk about the spirit world. Is it as close as we think? I mean, what are we supposed to be getting out of all this?
That's a very interesting point. And here's an example how I approach this. Resurrection Mary is our hitchhiking ghost.
Yes.
And many of your listeners may have seen me on Unsolved Mysteries in 94. It's the best-known hitchhiking ghost story in America, without a doubt. More documentation for that than anywhere else.
Yes.
Here we have a girl who, after death, she's been dead now 60 years, continues to come back to look for rides, to go to parties and whatever. She's on the highway out there walking about the cemetery. She's obviously been restless for 60 years, six decades, and people are, almost every tour, every group I speak to, say, well, why don't we do something to let her find rest, to put her down, to let her go on her way?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going, I think you're missing the big picture. Her personal agenda was to go out to parties and dances, and that's what motivated her to come back after death and do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You say she should go away, stop doing this, but look at the big picture. She has probably done more to cause people to contemplate the afterlife, survival of death, survival of soul, than any Bible-thumping, pulpit-pounding priest, minister, rabbi, whatever, all the way down the line in the last six decades, because they're talking secondhand experience, and here she is proving it firsthand that, yes, there is survival. And I think that when you look at it that way, even though some of these ghosts may seem to be embarking in tedious or frivolous-type activity, they're not, because they're causing us to reevaluate our situation, reevaluate our view of the greater cosmos.
Hmm. Interesting. Now, what? I guess when you're talking about being invited into Catholic churches, or not in the church, auxiliary, and you're being brought into the,
right, senior trips,
right, all those things.
I hesitate to say Lonely Hearts Clubs, but like
mm-hmm.
Singles groups, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I get a lot of those invitations.
Do you think that on a personal level, that a person has to be more open to these things for them to happen, or they just happen anyway? I mean, I guess being aware of your circumstance, does it happen to people who are believers and non-believers across the board? Does it matter what? You know what I mean? I mean, you've been at this for a long time. And,
right.
And so these things, you're looking for them. But I guess what I'm saying is, do you hear from people who aren't looking for this and they say, you know, you're not going to believe what happened? And they would have no prior experience or no reason to make it up or do anything like that. Do you see, Does that come too?
I do not mind skeptics as long as they're honest skeptics.
Right.
And those are the people who will come to me and say, I never believed this could happen. I never thought this could occur.
Mm-hmm.
It did happen to me, and now I know there's something going on, and they seek me out for extra input here in deciding what's going on. I don't mind that at all, but it's the people who are very prejudicial, who are closed-minded, who refuse to accept it even when it happens,
mm-hmm.
and then they make up some kind of very bizarre explanation, which is not an explanation, but a white a cover-up, if you will, whitewash of what happened to try to explain it away.
Yeah,
people aggravate me when they approach it in that fashion.
I guess
see the facts when it's right between their eyes.
Yeah, that's, I guess what I'm thinking is those people. I wonder if they're so closed that nothing happens, or if they're so closed that's when things should happen.
And once again, John, you have to observe, and you have to be able to put two and two together here.
Richard, is it even in the smallest parts of our lives, like, this may sound like a ridiculous question, of course there is no such thing, right? Little things, like I lost my keys, you know, the car wouldn't start, all these, you know, is there that much guidance in our life, do you think, from the spirit world, as it were?
I don't know if there's that much guidance, if you want to use the word guidance, but I think there's that much interaction.
Okay.
Here's an interesting example that I just learned recently on a Chinatown tour, in fact. I personally, as you know, I have an interest in anthropology and archaeology mm-hmm. and beliefs of peoples all around the world, and I certainly never put anybody's beliefs down, and I treat everybody with respect in that regard. I am the last, I don't want to get anyone mad at me this side of the beyond or whatever.
Right.
And I was talking, you're probably aware of this, I'm not sure if all your listeners are, about foo dogs. Those are the carved, usually you see them around Chinese restaurants,
right.
Chinese businesses. They're white marble, fierce-looking creatures carved in white marble, male and female, yin and yang, always a pair. They're the Eastern equivalent of the gargoyle, would be the best way to describe it. Just as gargoyles were used at medieval churches to scare away evil, they're not in themselves evil, but they're in the service of mankind. So in the Far East, we have these fierce-looking monster creatures that do the same thing. They guard the doorways. Well, if you can buy foo dogs 2.5 feet high to 5 foot high, whatever, mm-hmm. to stand out in front of your business, your home. But a lot of people just get smaller porcelain type foo dogs. They're just decorating items. But you use them with in the way they're intended. You have them face towards your front door to protect your entrance, to protect your property.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a couple on my tour had a pair of foo dogs, and they had them on their back porch looking out the back door, which is really not treating them in the way that they were meant to be used.
Yeah.
It's misusing these symbolic creatures, these ritualistic symbols. And they didn't realize it. They're going, yeah, we had a pair of these foo dogs. I'm going, where'd you keep them? Back porch.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't right. Anything happened? Well, come to think of it, we had a two-car garage. The cars were never starting right. We always had to call the auto club to get them jumped.
Uh-huh.
And eventually the garage burned down.
Oh, geez. Yeah.
So wow. There's an example.
Well, a lot of strange things going on. Richard, I appreciate you taking some time, clearing it up a little bit, bringing some of your expertise to the table. As always, it's a pleasure, and I look forward to it. But, you know, we got to do this not just Halloween time. We'll have to do this again here once you get not as busy. We'll do some things.
John, what I'm going to do is send you a calendar of things throughout the year, anniversaries and things to celebrate, so we can pick some other dates.
Thank you, Richard. Have a great day.
Thank you, John.
Bye-bye.